one exception, and he's an exceptional person in many ways for his stand against the war and over militarization. And I guess if Mr. Kucinich was elected, and he certainly isn't getting much press coverage, but if he was elected, chemtrails would stop.
And so would probably a lot of other nonsense as well.
I agree.
Real quick, are we ending at the hour, or do we have till 8:30?
We have until 8 o'clock, so we have 7 more minutes. If anyone wants to get in a quick last question, 464-8295. I'll try to put you on right away. I don't have a call screener here, so we'll put you right on if you have a question. One more time, that meeting is going to be at Monday, January 19th from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Vets Hall. I see we have a caller. Good evening, caller. You're on the airwaves. It's Will Thomas and John.
Hi, thanks for having me on. It's such a great, informative show. I really appreciate the information you're putting out there. And I was kind of clueless to the chemtrails here in Santa Cruz, and through, you know, looking at the photos on the web and whatnot, and just opening my eyes and looking up, I really did notice that we are getting sprayed all the time. And I specifically had a question for Will in regards to U.S. Title 50, Chapter 32. I was wondering if you maybe could give a little, you know, history on its revisions and how that affects the American people in getting sprayed.
That's a good question. I don't have much time for the history, but I could say quickly that that bill you referred to, that legislation, authorized the experimentation on the American public without their informed consent, as long as somebody, some official was notified, such as the local dog catcher. That bill was later amended to say that everyone affected by such experimentation must, in fact, be notified. So that bill has been changed. And I don't know about you, but I haven't been notified about any of this.
Or
asked my opinion.
I don't remember anyone asking me if it was okay to spray chemicals in the air.
If I may jump in and give a plug for my book, because I'm very excited about the new edition. I have lots of information on HARP, new developments in Italy, in Europe, in Russia. I will have that book out in about 10 days. And if I can, Tom, I have a... For people who want chemtrails confirmed, you can try this number, 1-866-470-0740. 1-866-470-0740. And as John mentioned, my website is willthomas.net.
Also, I just want to mention for all our friends and family in Santa Cruz that this is a very urgent issue. It affects all of us. The chemtrail phenomenon transcends any ideological, religious, or political boundaries. Left or right, Christian, Hindu, or atheist, we all breathe. And our health is foundational to our very lives. So please spread the word. Please go to our website, which is chemtrails911.com, and email the site if you'd like to be on our mailing list. We do have regular meetings, and we do have a core group of people, including professional people from the community who have stepped out, who are aware of this situation, and we are working together to put a stop to it. We want to make Santa Cruz a chemtrail-free, no-spray zone, and a model city for other cities to follow. We are being watched very closely by other chemtrail activists around the country, and we really invite you warmly to come and participate. Again, the website, chemtrails911.com, and our meeting Monday, January 19th from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Vets Hall.
Now, is Will Thomas going to be at that meeting?
Well, we're seeing if we can get a speakerphone so that we are going to show a video which includes Will Thomas and other researchers the first hour. And then the second hour, we hope to have Will on speakerphone for question and answer from the audience.
That's great. Great. Well, keep up the good work, folks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And it is good work, and I certainly endorse the work that you're doing down there in Santa Cruz. And I think that if we can get this stopped and turned around, a lot of things can be turned around.
There certainly seems to be groups organizing across the United States. I understand there's a Skywatch group happening down in the area of Taos, and and so forth. And so there must be others across the country.
There are groups around the country, and we're working with them. And, you know, honestly, it does appear that here in Santa Cruz, we are on the cutting edge. We're passionate about alerting our friends, families, and loved ones about this situation. It's incredible in this otherwise very enlightened and very health-conscious and very spiritual community, actually famous for it here in Santa Cruz, you know, including political activism, protesting illegal wars and this administration's policies, etc., that we can be so unfortunately blinded to what's happening so close to us. Our motto is look up, wake up, and speak out. And we invite you to join our crusade to make Santa Cruz a chemtrail free zone.
Okay, folks. Well, I want to thank you both one last time. It's going to be a chemtrail meeting Monday, January 19th from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Vets Hall, downtown Santa Cruz. That's the one right next to the post office. So thank you both very much, gentlemen.
Tom, thank you so much for having us on the show. And Will, it's been awesome as always.
Thank you, John and Tom. Very, very good evening.
Thank you.
Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Let me give you those calls, those numbers one more time. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us Bill Sardi. He's a health researcher, a health journalist who spends a great deal of time doing research. He's a good supporter of Radio Liberty and a good friend. Bill, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Dr. Stan. And, of course, we have a story tonight that just a short while ago would have been considered unimaginable.
Well, let's go ahead and tell the story. This is an entirely different audience, and I'm sure the people will be anxious to hear what you have to say.
Well, maybe your audience has heard me talking about things about red wine and some of its health benefits, but tonight I'm leading off with a story that's in the January National Geographic magazine, and it has something to do with all of this, something about living long and healthy. And people who are going down into mine shafts in Montana where they are breathing radon gas. Now, radium is sometimes down in the earth as a radioactive material in the crust of the earth, and radon is the gas of radium. And so it says here, according to the story in National Geographic, that people are entering something called the Merry Widow and the Earth Angel Health Mines in order to experience the miracles of inhaling radioactive gas.
Now, these are basically old gold mines, aren't they? They just happen to have some radon gas in them.
That's exactly right. And, of course, if for your for everyone listening, we can recall 100 years ago, a lot of this was considered health quackery. It was dismissed, drinking radium water and these kinds of remedies. And, of course, the world was just getting acquainted with radiation from Madame Curie on down. Of course, she died probably from toxic doses. Many of the radiologists in the beginning had no idea that radiation would cause the troubles it had, that it would. And, of course, they lost hands and various things. So it was difficult then to understand that radiation, of course, in a very toxic, concentrated dose, certainly then we became aware it was a problem. But we only assumed that low doses would be harmful to humans. And as this article in National Geographic points out, mining for miracles, now people are resuming going back to these radium spas and radium water springs, and some of them are in Austria and other places in Russia and so on. But here in the United States, they're going to these abandoned mines, down into the mine shaft, paying $3.50 an hour to sit there in a lighted mine shaft. And it says about 10 visits there. You can get in, I guess, 3 or 4 visits in a day. And they want you to sit there and, of course, breathe this radioactive gas. And, of course, we now know that this is involving a process or a phenomena that researchers have observed, for at least 100 years, called hormesis, H-O-R-M-E-S-I-S. Your audience will be hearing more and more about this. And, of course, hormesis, by definition, means something that could be toxic in a fairly hefty dose, given in just a very small dose to your entire body, might be some sort of a trigger to turn on a genetic survival mechanism, which would then bring about health benefits. And so this is what we see as we have seen low-dose radiation. Now, most people in the United States, if you go to the Environmental Protection Agency website, you'll see advice there to seal up the bottom of your homes, especially if there's radon gas coming out of the crust of the earth under your home, and that it's potentially harmful, causes 22,000 cases of lung cancer a year. But those aren't body counts. Those are extrapolations, which is what they believe happens when people breathe radon gas in a low dose. They have no idea, really. And it turns out that when you look at a map of the United States where the radon gas levels are the highest, those are the areas of the lowest cancer rates in the United States. So it doesn't fit. And, of course, there's something wrong here. And now, according to an article in WorldNet Daily, entitled Toxins Lead to Healthier Lives, this story posted on January the 3rd, and it's saying that small doses of radiation may actually be somewhat helpful, as well as other things that are considered slightly toxic. And it's even quoting a scientist from the Environmental Protection Agency from North Carolina as saying that this is revolutionary and we want people to be aware of it. It has the potential to generate substantial savings. What they mean is the Environmental Protection Agency is spending billions of dollars in cleanup sites and protecting people from radiation and so on. Maybe all of that isn't needed. Maybe actually it's not a poison. Maybe it's actually something beneficial. And, of course, that's what these people are saying as they go down into these mines in Montana. And, of course, you can go online and find some of these people and some of their testimonies saying, oh, they used an eye wash with the radium water and their cataracts went away and their arthritis is gone and their gout is under control, their migraines disappeared and so on. So there's a number of testimonies here from people who say that their lives were changed, that things were never the same after they went there and so on. And, of course, this mimics or duplicates some of the very same things that we see in research conducted in Japan. Before I go to the Japanese evidence, I will say that the on-assignment writer for National Geographic, a lady by the name of Kira Salak, Well, Kira goes to the Montana, goes down into the mines herself, said she was a bit skeptical, went there for a week, said that she, when she got there, she had a pretty bad cold, and it wasn't within a day or so it was all over with after going down in the mines. And as she says at the end, seeing my own cold go away, my perspective changed, and I became a believer. So, you know, National Geographic considered fairly high scientific standard by any means for what they write about. So it's remarkable. And, of course, all this hit Science Magazine in December, the highest-regarded science journal in the world, saying that something called hormesis, this phenomena we know about, where a small toxin might actually improve your life and your lifespan, is now gaining acceptance within scientific circles.
Well, you know, Bill, some years ago I went to a meeting of the Doctors for Defense Preparedness, and they had Dr. Bernard Cohen there. I subsequently had him on my program a number of times. But Dr. Cohen is a typical college professor, very well known, esteemed throughout the country. And, of course, he wanted to start out to approve the relationship between radon and lung cancer. And, of course, this is what everybody says. You know, you certainly have lung cancer. You have higher rates in areas where you have high doses of radon. But as you pointed out, it's exactly the opposite is the case. And he actually, if you've ever heard him talk, he has an hour talk of how they did every imaginable analysis of the figures. And the only thing that could come out after extensive studies, testing really millions of people in areas, evaluating them in areas with and without radon, was in the areas where there was low-dose radon, the people were healthier than the general population. And that took them back to an analysis of what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, of course, we've heard about the horrible radiation sickness and the number of people who died, not necessarily of the blast effect or of the fire, but of the radiation. But if you survive the radiation exposure in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese found that down through the years, these people were far healthier and lived lots longer than Japanese in other parts of Japan that were not exposed to radiation or to excessive radiation. And, of course, the Japanese have been aware of this condition you'd call hormesis for a long period of time, but it's been fairly well blocked out here in the United States because it didn't go along with the preconceived scientific notions. And one of the big tragedies I see is that in the name of science, people come up with an idea, and they're not interested in the facts. This is the way that it is. The EPA insists that radon is toxic and you're going to get lung cancer. And yet the statistics, when they're really evaluated, show exactly the opposite is the case. So what are we doing? As some people have thought, you're stimulating the immune system. You think that actually we are turning on and off certain genes?
Yes, absolutely. It looks like there's a genetic survival switch within the human body and actually all living organisms, and therefore we can test other organisms. Now, in Japan, they did a wonderful study. They took mice, and they exposed them to high doses of radiation, and 1 month later, there were 8% of those mice were still alive. Then they took another group of mice, and they exposed them to low-dose radiation. What we mean is ionizing radiation, like X-rays or gamma rays. And so they exposed those mice to a low dose, and then they let a period go by of adaptation for this survival switch to get turned on, because obviously the cells were threatened by something, so now this survival switch gets turned on, assumed. And then they gave the same mice the same dose of high-dose radiation that the other mice got, and 1 month later, 80% of these mice were alive, so from 8% to 80%. So there's a dramatic effect there. Now, there is a doctor in Japan who has taken 150 stage 4 cancer patients. No other treatment can be done. They're hopeless at that stage. And, of course, he gave them low-dose radiation. 84% of them survived 4 years, and 100% of those who survived 4 years survived 9 years. This is unheard of. In fact, the researcher himself got colon cancer, treated himself, and is now quite healthy and robust. So,
the radiation was simply to irradiate the whole body to stimulate this process.
Right. If you're going down for a chest X-ray or an X-ray of your wrist, this will not produce the effect. You need it in the whole body. You need it to be low dose. And, of course, then you seem to get this effect. And there seems to be a switch of anything that threatens living cells. Now, this there's a list growing with this. This may be heat. It may be starvation, which we're going to get into, called calorie restriction, or what the Bible calls fasting, really, or radiation, or we now even believe there's a way to mimic all this and to get something out of our diet that would throw the body and all of its living cells into some sort of a extra survival mode and produce super longevity like we've never seen on the planet before. And all of a sudden in the news media, this was on ABC News in December, it was in the New York Times, they were talking about something called calorie restriction. Well, when living cells are threatened with another biological threat, in this case starvation almost, well, then they seem to go into this same kind of extra healing mode. And of course, that's what's important for all of us to learn about. Calorie restriction produces the most profound extension, prolongation of life of any kind, about 70% in humans. And of course, this is considerable. You're talking about 30 to 50 years of extra life in human beings. So this is a tremendous thing. And along the way, about the end of the 1990s, the National Institutes of Health Institute on Aging said that the human genome was small. We had mapped it. Think of a small city map. We now knew our way around. It was only 30,000 genes instead of millions. By the way, that threw all the Darwinists and everything into a conniption, because they couldn't explain all the traits in humans being explained away by 30,000 genes. After all, some animals and even worms have more genes than we do, if you can imagine that. So genes alone couldn't explain man's complexity. But at any rate, man only has about 30,000 genes in his genome. And of course, thereafter, they discovered that single genes control the rate of aging. So if they could just find the right gene, they might be able to manipulate it. And what they were looking for was the genes involved in calorie restriction, because they knew that process of withholding calories from humans would produce super longevity and health. And they knew at that time, at the end of the 1990s, they said, we may be able in the near future to discover some sort of molecule that would mimic calorie restriction. That's exactly what happened in August of last year at Harvard Medical School. But I will say that, you know, there's a Dr. Tom Johnson at University of Colorado, and he has said that this is not science fiction. Humans are going to discover and find ways of living 350 years or more in good health. This is all possible, that humans are going to live as long as the Bible patriarchs. And of course, I'm trying to make this as real as I can. Pay attention to the citations, who I say I'm quoting when I say these are geneticists at major universities. I just quoted the University of Colorado. And now we switch our whole scenario over to Harvard Medical School, where Dr. David Sinclair was doing work on calorie restriction with yeast cells. Now, yeast cells are considered a model for human aging. They pick short-lived organisms. Yeast cells live a few days. Fruit flies live a few couple of weeks. They pick roundworms that live a few months. Mice that live a couple of years, because then they can test these organisms in a reasonable amount of time. Humans would take 100 years, obviously, to figure all this out. And what they were able to figure out was there was a certain molecule that mimicked calorie restriction, and that molecule was called resveratrol. This was all in Nature magazine in August of 2003. And resveratrol is a red wine molecule, and of course this was one of those discoveries of, sure, we should have known it all along. This explains the French paradox, the reason why the French actually have some health practices that aren't the best. They eat more fat, they have higher cholesterol, but they defy the kinds of health problems that should be occurring to them. For every one heart attack that the French have, North Americans have four heart attacks, they seem to be magically immune despite their heavy fat-laden diet. And we know it's related to their red wine. In 1991, a 60 Minutes television show unveiled the French paradox, the fact that the French were living longer and healthier. Two studies in France, 1933 and 1986, reveals to us that the people in the wine-growing regions of France live 25 to 45% longer. So we know that this red wine phenomena is here. Dr. Sinclair found the molecule that does this within red wine, and now maybe for the first time we'll be able to just take that molecule so we won't have to have the calories and the alcohol and the sulfite headaches that go along with it. And, of course, that'll bring us to the topic of the possibility now of what we might call an anti-aging pill. And this is actual reality. This is the highest science. This is not some bogus claim from the Himalayan mountains by some guru who just came down from the hills there. These are the highest caliber scientists we can dig up in the world. And they're relating all this to where we started the story tonight, a growing list of biological stress agents that may throw the human body and all of its cells or any living organism into a survival mode, and that would cause all the cells in the body to repair their DNA and not die off.
And, of course, you've actually met and talked to Dr. David Sinclair, haven't you, at
Harvard? Oh, yes. Visited Harvard and went there myself, saw some of the experiments underway as I was there, and, of course, more intrigue develops now because pharmaceutical companies and Harvard Medical School are taking objection to the possibility that this may become available to the public as a dietary supplement rather than as a drug.
And, of course, they want, of course, to have it as a drug so they can charge 50 times as much and, of course, maintain their control over the product. And yet, of course, it was good enough in red wine. Why does it have to be a drug? Why can't we just get it? Well, there's a lot of opposition. We'll be back in just a minute here with our special guest, Bill Sardi. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Bill Sardi. We're talking about the problem that we have, you know, as far as the pharmaceutical companies apparently are putting tremendous pressure because they don't want this product marketed simply as a health product. They want to be able to patent it so they can make the profit on it, somehow or other change the molecule around. But can they make a better molecule by doing that? Or is it simply that they have to have a patent on it before they can charge exorbitant fees?
Well, actually, if the molecule was vastly improved, there might be even justification for it. Unfortunately, it doesn't turn out that way. Nature's molecule seems to work the best at this moment. Also, when you start adding molecular tails and things to a natural molecule, yes, you can get a patent, but then that becomes the very definition of side effects. So we don't like these artificial molecules, and the body has a way of recognizing them as being something different. Now, I should say that resveratrol itself is considered a foreign molecule to the body. It only hangs around for 5 or 10 minutes. The liver tries to get rid of it, but in that time, it is a stealth molecule, very small, low molecular weight, goes right through the digestive tract, goes right through the cell wall, right into the nucleus of cells, and turns on a certain switch in there, which then makes it possible for the cells to repair themselves in an unusual manner. Normally, cells challenged by disease or aging, viruses and so on, would die off. But in this case, they're actually immune from these effects. In fact, they actually mimicked heart attacks, taking the oxygen supply away from the heart, taking it away from the brain, mimicking a stroke. But in animals pre-treated with resveratrol, nothing happened to the brain. Very little happened to the heart. There was very slight scarring, what we call necrosis of the tissue. So we can now understand why the French almost seem immune from these things. This is really maybe the most miraculous molecule ever conceived of and ever discovered. Of course, humanity has flittered and fluttered with this molecule for so long, all the way back to antiquity, because all the great ancient cultures of the world from Mesopotamia, Greece, Egypt, all were wine cultures. They produced red wine. The amphora jars are found in archaeological digs all over the world, and that's what, of course, they fermented their wine in and then allowed it to be stored in an airtight cap so it wouldn't turn into vinegar. And, of course, they had sophisticated ways of making wine way back then. So, you know, actually, this molecule's been around in a preserved form for quite some time.
In fact, and didn't Noah, one of the first things that Noah did after the flood was to plant a vineyard, and so he could begin to grow his grapes for the wine he was going to make.
It seemed to be a priority. His first priority was to build an altar to the Lord. His second priority was to plant a vineyard. So it somewhere was in there. In fact, Noah is known as the first drunkard in the Bible. But the we now are starting to put together some of the possible, plausible reasons why the patriarchs in the Bible lived so long. Not only did they drink red wine, but the red wine had an unusual amount of resveratrol that we don't find in our wine today. Most likely, the resveratrol levels were much higher. Of course, we don't have any wine vats left over to where we could test and prove that.
Hold our thought right there. We've got to pick up our stations up north here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Bill Sardi. We were talking about, of course, how the ancients, the patriarchs in the Bible, lived sometimes for hundreds of years. Methuselah lived 900 years, and of course people say, well, I don't believe that, and yet is there something in what they were doing? Was life different in those days? Was it perhaps something in their wine that allowed them to live much, much longer than we live today? We've got John calling in from Post Falls, Idaho. John, did you have a question for Bill?
Wow, what a great topic. This is a special area of interest in mine. I hardly know where to begin. First point, I'd hardly call National Geographic a good scientific source. After all, they've been foisting Leakey and Company's evolution on us for decades and calling it science.
Let Bill respond to that.
They sure have, and of course, we're just trying to say, you know, from the world standpoint of what they regard as high science, they're bending over with this story. This would have been considered quackery in the past. So understand how far they're going here.
All right. What's your other point, John?
Well, nevertheless, I don't deny homesis exists. In fact, I've heard of the phenomenon for a long time described as enzyme induction. I think it was Dr. Edward Teller was the first source that suggested that a little radiation might be good for you. But the $1 million question has to be that for a given individual, what radiation budget gives optimum immune stimulation? And that is very difficult to know. And, of course, we want to minimize direct DNA damage, so I'm still going to want to minimize my radiation exposure to certain non-regenerative structures. But modern life really muddies the equation. And, Bill, do you know, is there any sort of like a feedback loop mechanism we could have? Is there a way you can test your immune competence?
Well, of course, understand that if you can take stage 4 cancer patients who certainly would be immune compromised and pull them out of stage 4 cancer, you've really got something. The Japanese seem to know the level of radiation to use. In fact, we even have a machine that could do this for all of humanity. There is a radiation X-ray machine recently made from Australia. So when they bring a trauma victim into an emergency room, they can just kind of lay you on a little stretcher and a little kind of a C-arm, they call it, kind of scans you, zip forward, zip back, just kind of like a scanner you have, a computer scanner. And in 13 seconds, you would have a whole body X-ray of low-dose radiation. Well, the point is, they're trying to get a picture of your bones and tissues, but you could do this for all of humanity in 13 seconds. So instead of sitting there in that radon cave is the whole point. And you could actually deliver a measured dose, you see. The radium caves, we're not really sure exactly what's coming out there from minute to minute. But I assume exposure meters could tell us all that. But at any rate, why this thing seems to work. There's a Dr. Calabrese at University of Massachusetts at Amherst who seems to be leading the way. Dr. Cohen's in there, who's, of course, been on Dr. Stan's show. And now, finally, after years of banging their pie tins, the world's paying attention. This got in Science Magazine last month and so on. So all of a sudden, the world is turning around. And as we see, another thing has arrived on the scene, the talk of an anti-aging pill which scientists now consider a real possibility, and either that or calorie restriction as methods of producing super longevity. We're talking living 125 years in great health, just as Moses did in his day.
All right, John, we're going to have to go to a break. Do you have another question before we go?
Yeah, I actually do. Personally, I'm going with the caloric restriction, but the really difficult thing is calibration. But I've actually got a follow-up on resveratrol. How much time do we have?
No, we're just about out of time.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, thanks very much, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you. All right, later.
Yeah, right. Then we're going to have to go to a break here in just a moment. That was John calling from Post Falls, Idaho. And we're talking about, of course, the various means of turning on this gene that seems to slow down the aging process. And one of them is calorie reduction. And that's what John was saying. He's going with calorie reduction. And there's nothing absolutely wrong with that, except that most people are not going to restrict their caloric intake adequately. And then this idea of low-dose radiation, and certainly this is simply something completely new, but it's been used over in Japan really with really very exciting results, and I suspect it'll be used more and more. And they're beginning to talk about this effect of total body radiation to begin to trigger this immune response. And now, of course, this idea of using resveratrol, which is the molecule in the red wine that seems to be responsible for longevity. And when we get back, we'll be talking to Bill about some of the studies that have been done that verify there's a direct relationship. But we'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty, and we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Bill Sardi. We've got Brad calling in. He's a truck driver out of Spokane. Brad, did you have a question or comment?
Yes. You can probably hear me a lot better now.
Go ahead.
I don't know if you ever heard of Royal Raymond Rife.
Yeah, but that was a long, long time ago. That was back in the 30s, and he had a special type of microscope, and he also used certain different frequencies to attack different diseases. Yes, I know Royal Rife and his work very well.
Right. It was 11.67 megahertz, and they used that in the military to take care of certain bone deposits in your joints and that for years and years, I understand.
Right, well, right now, of course, any doctor who uses this is going to get into real problems because this is not accepted. But there was a great deal to this, and you sort of wonder why they were so upset with Dr. Rife. His crime was he was curing a lot of people back in the 30s. Did you have a point you wanted to make, Brad?
Well,
did you have a question for our guest?
Not specifically, other than I didn't know how many people knew about that, because anybody that's ever printed that book has gone out of business, and anybody related to it has either end up dead or shall we say, destroyed.
All right, fine. Well, thank you, but you're absolutely right. There was a great deal of interest in that many years ago, and I think there was probably something there. But thanks so much for calling, Brad. Of course, there are lots of things that we really don't understand, aren't there, Bill?
Well, there certainly are. Some of these are coming into view, and then, of course, you know, maybe there's this Rife generator, R-I-F-E, that people talk about. People are going to talk about anything from, is this mushrooms? Maybe this is why medicinal mushrooms work, or maybe homeopathy. That's where they take a little bit of a so-called homeopathic toxin and dilute it millions of times and then try to use this. But this is not homeopathy. It sounds like it, but it has to be something that's a very small molecule. It has to produce a whole body effect, whereas in homeopathy they say this fixes a cold, this fixes a headache. We're talking about something that fixes literally everything. This, I hate to use the word cure-all, but that's exactly what the resveratrol or the calorie restriction does. It prolongs life and virtually eradicates things like diabetes and Alzheimer's and so on. People live long and are super healthy because at the genetic level, all of the DNA is in the repair shop. Instead of the cells dying off, they're all being repaired.
Well, now, what would this do to somebody who already had some metal impairment or metal problems?
Well, we believe due to calorie restriction, what they've done is short-term calorie restriction in old animals.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, our guest this evening is Bill Sardi, and we're talking about, of course, the effectiveness of this resveratrol as far as people who have some metal deficiency, metal disability, premature aging, premature senility. And you were going to make a point there, Bill?
Well, of course, in animals where they just began short-term calorie restriction, it worked. It reversed aging, and in fact, it seemed to reverse many of the mental effects that we see in aging, the senility, and so on. So we now know that there's, of course, a mimic of this whole effect in red wine. We'll now be able to get it into a pill, a capsule of resveratrol, and, of course, then we'll be able maybe to even reverse a great deal of aging that's already taken place. Of course, this is a whole new arena. A brand new product is going to be unveiled in a few days. You can go find it on the internet now and place an order, as thousands already have. But because the problem with resveratrol, and by the way, it's a wonderfully encouraging story. Resveratrol is this wonderful little molecule in red grapes and 70 other plants, but it's extracted by the fermentation or alcohol extract in wine, and of course that's half of its secret because it's in the other plants, it's even in peanuts, but you've got to get it out of there. You get very little out of fresh grapes, none out of raisins or grape juice. Grape juice has already been heated up and pasteurized, so you won't get it that way or eating peanuts, but you do because it's alcohol extracted, just like the herbs are in the health food store. They're alcohol extracts. And then from that, it becomes a powder. There's no alcohol residue left. But the point is, the resveratrol molecule then slowly degrades, spoils, oxidizes, that is, mixes with oxygen, and disappears. And so virtually, as I was at Harvard learning this from Dr. Sinclair, we tested all kinds of resveratrol pills there in his laboratory. None of them exhibited any biological activity. So it was remarkable, and you see all these claims on the internet and products being sold wildly, the more we beat the drum on this wonderful resveratrol story. But I did get involved commercially in this because I had knowledge. We went to a company called Capsigel, and they make an airtight capsule where they put liquid ingredients into a pill under nitrogen rather than in an oxygen environment. Nitrogen will not cause the oxidation or spoilage. And, of course, they were able to take resveratrol from red wine that's already been extracted by alcohol, and then put it into a liquid capsule. And now it's alcohol-free. It comes without the calories or the sulfite preservatives. And now, for the first time, humanity will be able to get an adequate dose on a regular basis. I should say that red wine, while it provides it, some red wines provide none. Some provides 20 times more than others. So it's not a reliable source, but it is a consistent source in general of resveratrol. But now, for the first time, we'll have a measured dose of this. The product name is called Longevinex, L-O-N-G-E-V-I-N-E-X, the word vine in the middle. You can go to longevinex.com, or I did get commercially involved in this, so I need to disclose that to your audience. But I did help co-found this company and help them get this going. I am writing a book about this called The Anti-Aging Pill. And, of course, it documents all this along with the wonderful authority that this may authenticate many of the claims in the Bible. Way back when the Earth was first in existence, the crust of the Earth had more radioactive material coming out. The iron went to the center of the Earth, the radioactive material to the crust. And, of course, a fresh, brand-new Earth. People, humans, would have been exposed to more radiation and, therefore, more of this hormesis effect, more radon gas, etc., as well as the Earth was more moist. Even the evolutionists believe this. And in the Bible it says actually the water came from the Earth. It was subterranean water It was underneath the crust of the earth, and then it says it blew out of there. The fountains of the deep blew up. And, of course, then because it lost support for the ground underneath, the earth accordioned up into the mountains that we now see, and therefore the water being in the atmosphere would hit the mountains and then come down. And for the first time, we had rain, and, of course, that's believed to be the first reason why there was Noah's flood, of course, that great flood that lasted for a year. So, but in that early period of the earth, when Noah and Methuselah, who lived 970 years, and Noah, who lives 950 years, Adam lives 900 years, and they were exposed to more radiation, and also their grapes had more resveratrol, because as the earth was more moist, resveratrol is made in grapes to protect it from funguses, which are obviously more prevalent in a more moist environment, just like you see funguses growing in your bathroom where you have a water leak there. So there's more resveratrol made. So therefore, the grapes way in the past were obviously much more rich in resveratrol. And, of course, these were wine cultures in Mesopotamia and Greece and Egypt and from the ancient times. And so we believe that it may be another reason why the biblical patriarchs lived so long. These factors now coming into view scientifically to explain that the Earth's environment was different and our food was actually different, or at least the wine was. So, now we'll be able to acquire a dose of resveratrol, about 15 milligrams, equal to about 5 glasses of wine or more a day, without the alcohol in the Longevinex product. So what will actually happen there, we're not really sure, but certainly it'll be beneficial. We need to do as the French do. After all, obesity is rampant. We're eating a lot of processed foods and fatty foods. If we're certainly the calorie restriction crowd certainly has a chance of living much longer. This was all on ABC News. But when they found out about Longevinex, the people that were on the ABC News television show, all that were interviewed there have called up and all ordered Longevinex. So, you know, it is quite a discipline to restrict your calories down to 1,500 calories a day or so. You're going to look very gaunt. You're going to be very thin. It's just a real tedious task to try and do this. And of course, probably for mankind, it's not really practical. Though I must say, on the island of Okinawa, we have an example of calorie restriction. They're living super long there. They have thousands of people over the age of 100 on the Isle of Okinawa. This is a Pacific island off of Japan. They have adequate nutrition, but they don't get too many calories. And, of course, they're living very, very long. So there's our learning laboratory for calorie restriction. And then we go all the way over around the Earth to the Isle of Sardinia off of Italy, where they're eating a storm up. They're eating their pasta and so on, these Italians. But they have another cluster of 100-year-olds. And, of course, they're drinking their red wine, which is unusually rich on that island, with resveratrol. And, of course, we now see the French paradox. These people are using the calorie restriction mimic of getting this in their red wine. So, as I pointed out, the oldest woman in modern history, 122 years, Jean Calment, died about 4 years ago. She was French. She of course, drank her red port wine every night. By the way, she rode a bicycle at the age of 100, had a good sense of humor even at the age of 115. The oldest man in modern times, Antonio Todd, lived on the Isle of Sardinia, lived 115 years, died about 2 years ago. His slogan was, love your brother, drink 2 glasses of red wine every day. The Queen Mother of England died last year at the age of 100, outlived one of her daughters by 30 years. And, of course, it comes out in the London Times now that she drank 3 glasses of red wine a day. So I think we're starting to get the picture as I started to put this research together, combine it all into a book, and, of course, we love sharing it now because we're getting a focus on an idea that it is possible. I know a lot of people think, I don't want to live that long. No, you might want to live this long if you're this healthy, and it's going to be a reality. It's going to come into view. And understand, for all of those wonderful people supporting Radio Liberty and listening in, it's Dr. Stan Monteith who's been telling us all along, that they've been keeping these things away from us, whether it's at the beginning of life and they've been trying to push abortion or birth control, or at the end of life here and keeping us from living very long. The Environmental Protection Agency hasn't always recommended we be so afraid of radon gas. It wasn't until 1999 they cooked this up. I wonder if they didn't realize what a tremendous health benefit it would be, how much longer humans would live, and tried to keep this from happening. So you've got to wonder what the what their motivation was in saying protect all of your homes and seal them up from radon gas. When this evidence has been around for 100 years, I don't know if they can stop the storm of scientific interest now that seems to be swelling up over this hormesis effect from low-dose radiation. And now we have the possibility of an anti-aging pill, the resveratrol in the Longevinix product, and so on. All this is going to burst on the scene. How in the World Health Organization, all these population planners, the One Worlders, who in the world knows how much opposition you're going to get to this? The drug companies would rather see this as something to treat disease. Let people die, or let's treat it and make money on them after they get sick. The greatest application of resveratrol is keeping people healthy, just as the French do it. And now we could get it, possibly, without all of the alcohol and calories and all the drawbacks. Wouldn't this be a wonderful potential for mankind? We're just going to see what's going to happen. The drug companies are opposing the introduction of this product. They say they're going to report it to the FDA the second it gets on the market. They're opposing all this. The FDA may step in. Harvard Medical School has opposed this because they have patents involved. So they'd rather make money than save humanity.
Well, let's get your telephone number out, Bill. You were just going to tell us, and then you never got around to. How can people get in touch with
For people interested in the Longevinix product, 1-866-405-4000, 1-866-405-4000, and, of course, you can go to that website, longevinix.com, and learn more about it there. There's educational information and so on. And I will tell you, thousands of people have already lined up. The people that are in the know, the people that have been following this anti-aging story for quite some time, certainly know the story. And don't get bit and lose your money on the bogus products that don't work despite all their claims. Understand that we're going to have to sit down with ourselves for a little bit and understand we're entering a dramatic new era in the history of mankind. This is historic and unbelievably confirms many of the stories of super longevity in the Bible. If we recall, everyone else seems to be Johnny-come-lately here. It's the Bible that talked about fasting, which we now call calorie restriction. It's the Bible that taught a wine in moderation, which is exactly what we're talking about here. So, you know, things come late and history comes around to repeat itself. The Bible was right on these issues long ago. They knew something about all this. And, of course, we see super longevity in the Bible maybe now being fully explained by science.
Well, you know, this is an exciting thing that it works very well in animals. And one of the things you mentioned, that the animals that were actually taking the resveratrol, and then, of course, they would artificially produce a heart attack or produce a stroke, and they really did very, very well with it?
Exactly. And we think a lot of people in France are actually kind of having a moment when the oxygen supply is being deprived to their brain and heart, but they just don't seem to have the same effect or result because, or damage, because they're drinking the red wine every day. Now, there was a small village in the United States in the 1950s, Rosetto, Pennsylvania, of Italian immigrants, and they were virtually immune from a heart attack. For 30 years, there was not a heart attack in that village of men aged 55 to 64. It was a phenomena studied in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Later on, the heart attack went up, rate went up, and was equal to the rest of the population in the United States. And the sociologists got a hold of this and said, well, it was due to the breakdown of close family relationships. It had nothing to do with it. The Italian immigrants were importing their precious red wine from Italy, which was rich in resveratrol. And, of course, that was the real effect. And, of course, I was pleased to uncover this whole thing and be the first to report it. So we even had the French paradox 30 or 40 years before it was reported on 60 Minutes in 1991. We flittered around and missed this whole thing for far too long.
Well, now, of course, my understanding is that the tremendous pressure has been put on Dr. David Sinclair back at Harvard by the Harvard University because they want, of course, to have all the patents on this and, of course, then benefit Harvard University themselves.
Well, yes, Harvard Medical School, just put it to him bluntly, if he continued to work towards introducing a dietary supplement rather than supporting their drugs, he would find himself without a promotion at Harvard, which simply means you've been fired. So, actually, he went into an office. They had a dossier on him, me, Bill Sardi, and a whole bunch of other things there, and they confronted him with this. And, of course, he is fully legally able to do all this. It's just that they can exert pressure for him to, of course, resign from it all, and he's been forced to do that temporarily, at least for now. So you can see what's happening here, a great struggle as... there are four drug companies trying to make resveratrol into a drug, and of course, it will take years and years and years for that to become a reality, at least 10 years and millions of dollars at the very least, and of course, mankind suffering. In the meantime, we have all these health care bills we're paying for people, maybe it'll be a possibility to live long and healthy without being so sick, ill, and debilitated, and of course, it even has a reversal effect, so even if you're far along in aging and disease, this may reverse a great deal of it. So understand, it gets into the genetic machinery. It does not let tumor cells grow. It does not let viruses grow. I mean, what a wonderful thing for people with cancer or with hepatitis or other viral diseases and so on. It would just be a tremendous breakthrough.
And so, of course, right now Harvard and the other working in concert with the drug company is trying to keep this from being released. And actually, this is simply resveratrol, and it's placed into a capsule in a nitrogen atmosphere, which allows it then to be active when taken internally.
Right.
So it doesn't degenerate as most of the resveratrol does. So they're not concerned about the resveratrol on the market. They're concerned about one that would actually work because, of course, it's not going to be oxidized.
Exactly. The ones on the market now simply have no biological action. There's hundreds of studies where red wine produces unusual health benefits. Not one study with a resveratrol pill. We now understand why. There's nothing that works in there. You have to duplicate that cork on a wine bottle, that is, keep the air out. That's what's been done for the first time in the Longevinex product. But it will be wonderful to see what's actually going to happen with this now that it's going to become available to the public.
And so how soon will it be available?
Oh, people will be having product shipped within 10 to 12 days. The product is all produced. They're just printing some extra boxes here, and so people can place orders now, and they'll be shipped to them rather short.
And that number, again, is 866-405-4000. That's 866-405-4000. And let's go to Alan in Spokane. He wants to talk to Bill. Hi, Alan. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, sir. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate that. My mom has stage 4 lung cancer, and earlier in the program, Bill said something about the radiation and stage 4 lung cancer, and I was wondering how to get more information on that and where I could go to maybe take my mom to get that low-dose radiation.
Right. I don't believe that any place in the United States will expose your mother to low-dose radiation. All the radiologists and all of the radiation exposure laws prevent this. Now, I will tell you that in the story in my book, a man 81 years old with untreatable stage 4 lymphoma found out about this effect. I told you about the doctor in Japan that treated the stage 4 cancer patients. He then went to the highest regarded medical institution in the United States, on the East Coast, and of course went there and talked to them about whether they would do this for him. It took him 2 years to get around the radiologists and all that. They finally did the treatment. He survived up to that point, and now he's lived another 8 years, and the disease has disappeared since he had the treatment. There's no question this is an absolute miracle. You're never going to be able to find a place. This was at Johns Hopkins University. You're going to fight the establishment and all these rules and laws and everything. We believe that the same gene switch which the radiation does, is what the resveratrol does. So we believe that's probably a more acceptable, a more available chance for us to see what this would do, because we're never going to be able to, I mean, they're wearing radiation badges and all this, and they're going to, it's going to, you know, they just have a certain phobia about all this that you can't be overcome. Radiologists who would do this would be fired immediately for violating certain rules and laws. And as it's been said, there's just no way to get around these things for the moment.
And okay, so the trouble is, Alan, that they have all of these laws here to help us, and it's killing us.
Right. I was going to say too. What about? I live close to Canada. What about in Canada?
Understand that the radiation laws in the world are international. This is an incredible thing, but there is an international rule and laws and codes, and this is all enforced in this way. So they've standardized this around the globe, and of course, doctors in Japan who did this had to get special provision, had to wait till these patients had no other treatment that could be done for them. The patients had to pay for the treatment out of their own pocket, and then that they were able to do just 150 patients to show this. So believe me, it's going to be difficult to get this through. I just don't know how to, as I say, you can hear me hesitating here. To mention things on the air and then build people's appetite for it is certainly a letdown. My suggestion is, obviously, I wouldn't have be going on the air here without telling you there is a way, a direction for you to go, and the best way to go is to get this resveratrol. By the way, while you're talking about cancer, it's Dr. John Pizzuto from Purdue University, who was sent around the world to 30 different countries, examined 30,000 different natural molecules to find out which ones are the best at preventing cancer. His result and conclusion of his study, resveratrol is by far miles ahead as the most potent anti-cancer agent on the planet. This was a study conducted and sponsored by the National Cancer Institute. Believe me, this is a remarkable and magical story. What resveratrol will do for cancer patients, I don't know. I can only tell you this. Longevinex can't be marketed as a cancer treatment. It's up to you to learn about its potential and use it judiciously on your own. But it can only be promoted as a wonderful alternative to red wine without the alcohol and preservatives and so on. So,
Alan, I'm going to have to let you go because we've got one more caller here, and that's Theodora, who's waiting patiently on the line for us. Hi, Theodora.
Hi, Dr. Stan and Bill Sardi. Always a good program when Bill's on. I had a couple of questions on the... Is there anything on your website? Apparently, it's not on the Longevinex website, but is there anything on your website that goes into detail?
Yes,
about...
I do have an article on my website at askbillsardi.com that says it's entitled something like, "Is 125-year lifespan possible?" And you can go there. I believe it's under the topic of longevity, and you can see the report there as I've tried to summarize this in the best way I can with references and so on in a short article that tries to explain it to you, that this is actually credible, believable, first time in history, pinch yourself. What you're hearing here is not a phony pitch on coral calcium or something like that. This is the real McCoy.
Okay, and then the other question was, are you familiar with ellagic acid?
I am familiar with ellagic acid. Now, ellagic acid is from... like we find it in pomegranates and so on.
And red raspberries and strawberries.
Red raspberries and so on. Again, when we look at the molecules, what we're looking at is their molecular weight. You can actually go online and find out what they are. And you'll see that resveratrol has an unusual configuration. It's extremely small, just a little smaller than ellagic acid. And, of course, it's able to get through. It's just its remarkable stealth properties that make it able to get in. It throws its monkey wrench way deep into the cell in little tiny areas where our genes are. So that's its little secret. They did test about 50,000 different molecules, natural molecules, and nothing's beat resveratrol at this point, not even the drug molecules yet. So
Great, great.
Anything else, Theodore?
Well, no, just good to hear this good information.
In fact, Longevity Magazine, a friend of mine, has the latest issue, and there's a big article in Longevity on resveratrol.
Okay, Longevity Magazine?
Yes.
Are they on the web?
I don't know.
Yeah, they are. You'll find them on the web.
Hey, Brian?
Yes, you can find it on the web.
Okay.
Fine.
Thanks so very much,
Theodore. Thank you.
Well, Bill, we're just about out of time. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners tonight?
Well, take great hope. A wonderful thing may be ready for humanity. And, of course, believe in God, because it's God who wrote about all these things. We're Johnny-come-lately discovering it all. And, of course, let's tap into what God originally planned for us. And, of course, this is a wonderful confirmation for everyone who has wondered about these wonderful tales of people living so long in the Bible. Now it's going to be possible for us to do the same. So I think it's a remarkable day and age. Maybe this is all going to come true.
Well, we'll certainly hope and pray. Well, anyway, again, that telephone number is 866-405-4000. That's 866-405-4000. If you want to be interested in getting a copy of this program tonight, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Thanks so very much, Bill. We'll be talking to you later, and God bless you.
Thank you.
And, of course, I just want to ask you to pray for America, to pray for our leaders, our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And I'm going to be away for a few days. I wouldn't be back with you. Maybe sometime next week. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Good evening once again. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you want to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We'll open up later in the program, and I'll ask for calls when we're ready for them. But with us is Sarah Leslie, and Sarah is a researcher, and she's been doing some amazing work on the church growth movement, but specifically on the guru of the corporate realignment, the corporate management, government management, and now the church management industry. And no longer are churches houses of God, they're industries. How do you reorganize those to make them more efficient? How do you reorganize Christianity and change its message and its music? Without the public even having any idea what's going on. Sarah Leslie has published Charlotte Isabey's book. Those of you who have read The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, I'm sure have enjoyed it. If not, why we do carry the book. But Sarah, of course, has been suddenly stumbled across the story of Peter Drucker, one of the most significant men in the world. And, well, I'm going to let her tell the story. Sarah, pick up the story from there.
Okay, thank you. Nice to be here. Well, as you know, I've been researching education reform for the last two decades, and this man, Peter Drucker, was not even on my radar screen. In fact, I can tell you that most of the people who you know as the leaders in education reform research, they can tell you the same thing. This man was not on our radar screen. It wasn't until I was researching Bill Bennett and his foray into charter schools a few years ago that I ran smack dab into Peter Drucker and also into the church growth movement. And I was a little shocked, but the more I dug, the more I found out that this makes perfect logical sense, that Peter Drucker, the management guru, would be behind a huge chunk of education reform. And let me explain what I mean, because I'm not a management expert. Most people think of Peter Drucker as the management guru. In fact, I found reference where he calls himself that. I talked to my father, who's been in corporate management for years and years, and of course he was familiar with Peter Drucker, and everybody just assumes that he was the man who came in and transformed General Motors back in the late 40s, early 50s, and that sort of was his legacy. That's what his moniker was. He went through life with that, and so he wasn't on the radar screen to think about education reform or church reform, but that's indeed where he has been for the last several decades.
Well, now here's a man who's almost 100 years old, who has actually came from Europe, and I want you to go into the back his background, because he really ties into this same German mysticism that gave us Adolf Hitler and the Nazi movement, which was based upon mysticism. You're not told that, but the whole driving force behind Hitler's ability to accomplish what he did and to control people was the mysticism. And you pick up the story from there.
I was really surprised to figure out that Peter Drucker is nearly 100 years old. And he publishes, there's been quite a few biographies on him, and he publishes his own life story on a certain website. And it's not too hard to figure out that his parents were part of something called the Vienna Circle, which was the cutting edge of all the psychological and spiritual reforms that were going on in Vienna at the turn of the last century. And the people who were known in this circle were steeped in what we would call German mysticism. And sure enough, the research we've done takes us back way into the early 1800s with Hegel and Kierkegaard later, and Kant, all of the and all of the German theosophists, Madame Blavatsky and people like that, that concocted new ideas about man and spirituality, and actually they borrowed from old occult ideas, I should say. But the generation of Peter Drucker's parents and then Peter Drucker himself, they took these mystical occult ideas and turned them into what they tried to make rational science, behavioral science, social sciences, and called them science, and turned this mysticism into theories about human behavior. And that's what Peter Drucker did. His management theories are largely based on his particular religious and spiritual worldview, which is that man is incomplete without being part of an organism. And if you study this worldview, it quickly becomes apparent that it's evolutionary. They believe that man is evolving and that we will become a corporate organic whole, truth itself is evolving, that God is evolving. And so this new paradigm in everything that we see for the last two or three decades is all based on this new age esotericism. So Peter Drucker came over to the United States after studying economics in England, and he transformed the corporation. That's what he did the first third of his life. He re-engineered the corporation. He's the man who's known as management by objectives, which now we would call total quality management.
Well, is this where you sort of get into these meetings and you go on and on and on, and it seems like you talk to anybody in the corporation, they're always at a meeting?
Yeah, well, that's what my father said. And, of course, he's a generation ahead of me. And so, yes, indeed, he said that that's what that was noted for, the management by objectives, was a lot of meetings, a lot of teamwork, a lot of you know, people talking about things but not necessarily working.
But now, wasn't a lot of this using the dialectic in these meetings so that, you know, you never really come to conclusion but sort of come to a consensus? And
yes.
And, of course, they're playing mind games with the individuals. They're learning how to manipulate the individual to take away their individuality. They become part of the group.
Yeah, I think that as I look back over some of Peter Drucker's writings, and by he's very prolific writer by all means. I have not studied everything he's written. I think he originally envisioned the corporation sort of like the Japanese model, where the corporation would substitute for all of our life's needs, you know, take care of us from cradle to grave. But he switched gears about midlife and began working with the government, with the state. And then the last part of his life, since the late 70s, early 80s, he's devoted all of his efforts to what he calls the private sector. And that's what we would call the nonprofit. Churches, social service agencies, schools, that kind of thing. And he basically is transforming everything into the same model, which the language is almost identical. And this is what really threw me. We're talking about producing results. We're talking about having measurable results, assessing people, creating social health, everything being customer-driven, core competencies. Where have we heard all this before? Assessment, accountability, results, outcomes.
Sounds like outcome-based education to me.
It's the same thing.
Right.
It's the same thing. And lo and behold, I discovered that Peter Drucker has not only adopted this idea of human capital, but he actually has come up with his own particular twist on the concept of human capital. Now, those of the people who are in your listening audience who remember the early years of education reform will recall that there was a man that went around the country proposing various plans named David Hornbeck. And David Hornbeck went from state to state with nearly an identical plan for every state to transform education. And in this plan, he referred to our children as human capital and inferred that they had a value or a worth in society that could be measurable and that they could be held accountable for their results. And in fact, he proposed this humongous education reform system that would be driven by test results, these assessment tests, touchy-feely, and that these assessment tests would drive the whole reform engine, and that there would be rewards and penalties accompanying these this reform.
Sounds like No Child Left Behind.
Well, yes, he's actually been codified into federal law now. His exact plan is now coming to fruition, and it's an Orwellian plan. It's horrible, and the onus rests on the child how well they perform on this test. Well, Peter Drucker wrote a landmark paper back in 1994. It was published in Atlantic Monthly. And anybody can access this on the web. It's very easy. You just go to a search engine and type in the title. The title of this is called The Age of Social Transformation. The Age of Social Transformation. And in this particular article, it's sort of a summary or a culmination of his life's work. And he proposes that every human being, I say on the planet, because I'm sure that's what he's getting at. He's talking about a global economy. Be assigned a human value or worth based on their knowledge capital. And he refers to knowledge, possessing knowledge, as how much capital you have, how much worth you are to society. And as we have seen from the assessment tests that have come out of No Child Left Behind, he proposes something called value added, which means that every year you would be assessed on how much you had increased your knowledge capital. And your value to society and to corporations, to governments, and to the community would be how much knowledge capital you possess. Well, I know people that don't possess a whole lot of knowledge capital, and I'm sure you do too. And I know people whose knowledge capital probably decreases every year. It doesn't increase. Well, Peter Drucker talks about basically a two-tiered society where you're going to have the haves, the people who are extremely well-educated, cradle to grave, lifelong learning, and then you're going to have people in a service sector who aren't going to have very much knowledge capital, and those will be the servants. And this is how he envisions his global economy.
All right, well, of course, he's one of the elitists who want to remake society, but, of course, my concern over Peter Drucker is his involvement with the church growth movement, because if you read the writings of people like Rick Warren and Bill Hybel, they all refer back to Peter Drucker as sort of the guru who's put out this whole idea of corporate management in the church. And the corporate management, of course, is the people in the church, and they will be manipulated into the groups. They will change their attitude towards God and towards the music, and they'll bring in this terrible, terrible music under the guise, well, God produces everything. He produces music. God loves all music. He loves this outlandish music. Sounds like it came right out of the pit of hell, and I think that some of it did. But what's really happening is the transformation of the message and the music of the Christian church as it changes direction from what it was the bulwark of our society to what Peter Drucker would like it to be. And, of course, it's his people that are transforming the church today, with over 350,000 ministers having it, and, of course, lay leaders having attended the indoctrination programs by which they have learned how to indoctrinate the people in their church, how to manipulate the people in the church, how to destroy anybody in the church who doesn't want to go along with the new program. And they're laying out an entirely different direction for the church. Have you looked into that at all, Sarah?
Yes, I have. And again, it was not directly. It was sort of through the back door researching some other things. It turns out Peter Drucker has a theory about the way government should be set up. And he calls it the three-legged stool. And on one hand, you have the corporations, the business. And then another leg of the stool is your government. And the third leg of the stool is what he calls this private sector, nonprofit sector. And his stool, when you start really examining what he's saying closely, you quickly realize that it only has one leg, and that's the government. With that in mind, what he began working on in the late 70s, early 80s, was this nonprofit sector, and he decided it needed to come into compliance with all of the corporate structure that he had just changed. So he began working with some men from Fuller Theological Seminary, Rick Warren, Bob Buford, Bill Hybels, a number of other leaders that we would recognize, and they began instituting some pilot projects, some of which we would recognize today as Willow Creek and Saddleback, and they began pouring monies into this and what they call technical assistance, which is where they come in and they teach the pastors, the leaders, how to transform their church. And basically, he set up what we'd call a customer-driven model for the church. And he particularly wanted to focus on this knowledge capital type person, the people who are in the high-tech industries, the families that are on the cutting edge where both the husband and the wife work, and they're living a real modern lifestyle and totally caught up in, well, what we'd call the world from a Christian perspective. And this had great appeal, especially because these churches were undergirded very heavily financially to get this off the ground, but also because it was pop culture. You know, there wasn't any doctrine of nonconformity or separation taught in these churches. And, of course, you mentioned the music. that's probably one of the key characteristics of this entire church transformation is using music in a different way and not preaching from a didactic perspective anymore. In other words, everything became dialogue and consensus and these little touchy-feely things.
Well, we really didn't get into what God said, but it was how you felt about it. And then they use all the different translations of the Bible, so you're not quite sure what the Word of God is. And how can you know when you have all the translations? And that's why they do it, because it all has to do with creating confusion, and then out of confusion and disorder will come the new synthesis. Let's go right now to Tony, who's calling in. Tony, how you doing?
Fine. I have a question in regards to your education and value. If someone with a higher education obviously has a higher value, what do you do with the dropouts? What do you do with the kids who drop out of high school or don't finish and who end up working at lower income jobs? Do they become waste product or something? Or, how are they treated? How is that treated?
I'm kind of curious to know the answer to that myself. It appears, just from my brief research here, that he's setting up a two-tier society, the haves and the have-nots. The knowledge sector people will be running the world, and the service sector people, like the people that flip burgers at McDonald's, they're the ones that aren't going to, have all the benefits and perks and rewards and whatever. This whole system...
And at what point in time does the burger flipper who develops an education or develops enough knowledge to move beyond that point move into the upper tier?
That's a good
question. Or does he ever?
That's a good question. I'd like to know the answer to that myself. I'm not quite sure. I just know that from all that I've read since No Child Left Behind and all of the key reform leaders, Chester Finn, Bill Bennett, a number of other reform leaders, are writing about this value-added assessment, meaning that you have to perform better every year than you did the year before. You have to demonstrate that you have improved your skills, that you've improved your attitudes, beliefs, feelings, values, whatever, and brought them into closer conformity with whatever the state determines is acceptable. And so I'm concerned about the people who are handicapped, who are not going to improve every year, and I'm concerned about the people who, for whatever reason, don't perform better the following year on this assessment.
I really think, Tony, that we're talking about an elitist concept, and there are probably very strong racial connotations, and all of this really goes back to its occult roots. You read the occult writings, and they were very, very much racist, looking down upon other races, specifically on the blacks and the Jews and the Hispanics, and of course it was the Anglo-Saxons that were to be the elite in this new society, and you can't divorce any of the things that Peter Drucker is talking about. If you don't get back to the occult roots, Madame Blavatsky, the Theosophist, and if you read Madame Blavatsky, this woman, of course, was the ultimate in racist.
Yeah, that's right. Another facet that Peter Drucker wrote about in this paper called The Age of Social Transformation that was published in the Atlantic Monthly is he proposed assigning everyone a voucher. And, of course, they call these portable vouchers in the educational choice movement, where everybody on the planet who's assessed and given this value-added knowledge capital worth, they're assigned as a voucher. So you take this voucher wherever you want to go. It sounds like an ID or something. And, of course, a lot of the key reformers have been writing for years and years about education reform, that they would like to completely demolish public education. And that's kind of surprising to people from the liberal left, because they think that education reform is all about propping up public education. But in reality, what they want to do is assign every child a voucher in which they can go to whatever publicly funded school they want to. And that, of course, will obliterate homeschooling and Christian schools as we know them, because everyone will have to come into the system when they do that. So this is one way I ended up researching Peter Drucker, is because I was researching Bill Bennett and his charter schools, and realizing that this was this educational choice that the Republican conservatives were talking about was truly government-controlled choice. But I also discovered that Peter Drucker has been one of the architects of what we would call the faith-based movement. And the faith-based movement is where the government is now giving monies to private charities and church groups and organizations that didn't used to get this kind of money. And what I discovered is that there's strings attached. I guess that's not a surprise when you get government money, is it?
No, not at all.
Tony, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
No, Doc. I appreciate it very much, and I'll keep listening.
Okay,
take care.
Brian, thanks very much.
God bless.
That was, again, you too. Bye-bye. That was Tony from Capitola. And go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Sarah.
Oh,
but,
no problem.
Tony was listening very patiently, and I wanted to give him a chance to say something else or let him go. So go ahead now. You're talking about the faith-based movement. And, of course, has this actually passed? Are they actually beginning to give money to the churches? Or is this, is it really going on?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Now, the first few years of it, as I understand it, that the churches just didn't jump on board gung-ho, and I was happy about that, obviously. But now they've come in through the back door. There's a number of people who are closely associated with Peter Drucker. One of the names, Bob Buford, is a leader in all of this, and he has his own... All of these men have these institutes and organizations that always use the word leader, because that's what they're focusing on, is the change agents, I guess. But they've come in to these faith-based movements through the private foundations. What they have done is persuaded or set up some private charitable type foundations. And these foundations are going around teaching other foundations on how to give money. And they're starting to demand, and I mean this literally, demand accountability for results. And in other words, if you have a little storefront pantry that's running out of your church and you distribute canned goods to the poor people in your neighborhood, and maybe you've relied for years and years on a little private family foundation to give you a few thousand dollars to help you run this. If this little family foundation gets through this training that Bob Buford and a few other men offer, they will come into your little food pantry and say, well, now we need to have a strategic plan. And you have to have measurable goals. And we need to assess your outcomes. So you need to specify, how are you helping these families, and how much progress are you making year to year, etc. Well, the government comes in with the same exact plan, only, of course, the government demands a whole bunch more accountability, to a point where you probably have to use a major part of the government monies just to hire somebody on your staff at this little food pantry to fill out all the government forms.
You know, the thing, apropos of that, I was reading the other day, you know, when what's happening to medicine. And when I was practicing here in Santa Cruz, we used to have about three people working in the office of this 50-bed hospital, 50 patients in the hospital. Of course, you had your nurses on the floor, but we didn't have a lot of paperwork. The government came in. Today, it said that you spend half an hour on paperwork for every hour the patient's in the hospital. They're in the hospital 24 hours. Why, of course, you've got 12 hours of paperwork. And this is what they're doing, is they're simply running our costs up with all the paperwork. And think of all those trees that are being cut down unnecessarily. I mean, where is the environmental movement when you really need them?
Well, they can put it all on computer nowadays, I suppose. But yeah, this is definitely a whole different move, and it's very closely tied in with the purpose driven church. In fact, I call it outcome based church, because you can easily substitute the word outcome for purpose and based for driven. And that's indeed what's being set up, is a church that will more closely conform to what the government, and I mean the government of transformation that we're seeing in education reform, is demanding. I honestly believe in a lot of ways that they're setting up a state church. And the reason I say that is because those churches that don't conform, that don't go with the plan, are probably going to be penalized, ostracized, marginalized, even possibly persecuted, because they're different.
Well, actually, this is part of the plan, though, how to deal with the people in the church who don't want to go along with the brave new departures they're undertaking. My understanding is that on Rick Warren's website, they actually have areas where they tell you how to deal with dissenters, those people in the church who want the old-time religion, who don't want to go along with this wonderful new progressive situation, how to manipulate them. I thought Christianity had to do with the worship of God, not learning how to manipulate the people in the church. And yet that seems to be exactly what's going on.
That's right. That's definitely right. They have a continuum. And I first saw this continuum drawn in cell church literature. And the cell church literature was something very popular during the decade of the 90s, which laid the groundwork for a lot of this transformation. It talked about putting people in little cells and having them change with these touchy-feely groups, sometimes confused with home church, but it's definitely not, because it's controlled from on high.
When I was at cell church, similar to what they're setting up with these small groups that they're having in the seeker-friendly church?
Yes, there you go.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Sarah Leslie. If you have a question or a comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. The most amazing phenomenon is sweeping Christendom here in the United States today, and it's infiltrated the Jewish religion, it's infiltrated the Muslim religion. Everything's changing, ladies and gentlemen, and most people don't have any idea what's really happening. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to, of course, remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us, we hope that many of you will decide you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us. It's 5 hours a day. We reach out across America, across the world, with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And then we want to mention that we're talking about the church growth movement. There's a wonderful video. It's called Dioprax in the Church. That's Dioprax in the Church. It's by, of course, Dr. Robert Klink. And he goes into the background of this whole church growth movement, the seeker-friendly church, the purpose-driven church, this movement that is sweeping America, and our major churches are going into this. And the people are going along because, after all, our churches wouldn't be doing something was wrong. And, yes, we don't like the music, but sometimes the message is not necessarily biblical, but it's very entertaining. And sometimes the minister will actually, of course, have a very good message. But, of course, you're going to have to sign a contract to stay in the church and to join these groups. And if you don't want to go along with it, you're not going to be allowed to join the church. You've got to sign a contract for... But you don't understand what the contract's all about. It's almost like when you go into masonry and you have to swear that you want the light to come into your life, but nobody ever tells you what the light is. But, of course, you swear these oaths to protect this information, and you don't even know what the information is. And in the church today, you're being asked to sign a contract for, well, you're not quite sure exactly what the contract is for or where you're going, but it's all based upon trust. But who are you trusting, the minister? Are you trusting Bill Hybel and Rick Warren? Are you trusting Peter Drucker? Are you trusting the mystical forces that energize these men because they have a different goal and they seek a different church than the gospel of the Church of Jesus Christ? And we've known, oh, this is a process that works, and it works very efficiently. People are streaming into the churches. But you can see its effect on society and how much better society is getting. Or is society getting better? Is the church losing, of course, its calling? Well, the bride of church, bride of Christ, is changing from the bride of Christ to the bride of perhaps some other mystical force. And so if you'd like to learn more about this, the video that we suggest is Diaprax. If you'd like more information on Diaprax, a 2-hour and 20-minute video that will change the way you look at the church growth movement. The number to call is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And it's vitally important that you out there in the listening audience get the information and that you help us disseminate this. The greatest threat that we have in America today is not, of course, coming from Washington. It's coming from the church itself. Well, Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Sarah Leslie. We're talking about Peter Drucker. We're talking about his impact on corporations and how he has remade the corporations and how, of course, what you're doing is learning how to manipulate the people in the corporate body to make it run more efficiently for the ultimate goal, and that is the profit of the corporation. And then, of course, these same concepts moving over into government and into education, and now, of course, moving into the church. And, of course, the whole fundamental purpose behind the church growth movement is learning how to manipulate the congregation. This is what it's all about, how to get rid of the people who don't want to go along with it.
Right.
Gee, that doesn't sound very, very Christian, but this is not based upon Christianity. It's based upon a corporate management. And that's
that's
what it's all about. And yet, of course, it's being brought into the church as if there was somehow a Christian movement, which it is not. So you pick up the story there, and if you're out in the listening audience and you agree or disagree, give us a call. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go ahead, Sarah.
I was going to mention that when I was reviewing the Cell Church literature, they had this diagram that showed this continuum. On one end of the continuum, you had the innovators. Those are the leaders who want to change and transform the church. And at the other end of the continuum, they had what they called laggards. And laggards are the people who are just real slow to change. They drag their feet. They don't want to go. They don't like the new music. They don't like the new worship style. They don't like this new theology. Those are the people who end up leaving churches that get transformed this way. And that's probably the group you and I would find ourselves in. Well, they've got names for us, the laggards, and they are very happy when we leave.
But don't they really design things to make you leave, to force you to leave?
Yes, they do. And they're happy to see you go. I mean, openly happy about it. Rick Warren has written that, like you said. And so they don't want the stumbling blocks in the church. They don't want people, you know, when you sign that covenant to join the church, Rick Warren has a 3-part covenant, and one of those is you have to agree not to question the leadership.
Not to question the leadership. In other words, it's sort of blind obedience like you would in the
yeah.
military or in the Nazi Party, the Communist Party.
Yes.
What's this have to do with Christianity?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I want to know, because there's clear performance expectations that come into this church-type structure. I don't know that we see it quite so much now, but I've seen glimpses of it by studying the church, the Cell Church movement back in the 90s. And I can tell you that the structure that they're putting in place is basically site-based management that we saw, you know, in the Ed Reform. And it's built on a hierarchical model where the local church will report to a citywide or regional-wide board of elders. And these are self-appointed, self-anointed men who are deemed to be leaders of this new transformative model. And some of these men actually call themselves apostles and prophets, and some of them even have the audacity to make it with a capital A and a capital P, meaning that they've been gifted like the early apostles and the biblical prophets. But these men have set up some pilot projects around the country where they set up a citywide church structure. And it was top down. It was extremely extremely authoritarian, and they demanded compliance from the local churches and the local pastors, and those pastors that didn't go along were penalized.
Well, now, how would you penalize a local pastor who didn't want to go along with this program?
Well, one pastor that I know in particular where one of these citywide models was first implemented was falsely accused of child abuse, a family member was, and he was marginalized. And at every opportunity, they said, oh, he's just a radical freak. You know, he's one of those really fundamentalist types. They had names for him. And they tried to portray his church and his congregation as, you know, fundamentalist kooks. So, you know, you start using words like extremist, you know, and you get connotations in your mind. So, I tell people that the way the structure is probably going to work is all of these business models have assessment tools now that they want to bring into the church, and they have computer programs. I predict that Rick Warren will be endorsing some sort of a software program here in the next year or two. There is already one called purpose-driven software, but they need to data bank the church, and they've got programs that already do this. But they'd like, you know, I'm sure that there's going to be some global program, but they want to know what's happening to the people in your church. So already people are being data banked that don't even know they're being data banked.
Well, now, aren't the people in these churches asked to, of course, join these specific classes, 101, 201, 301?
Yeah.
And what do they do in those classes? Do you have any idea?
Well, they get more and more indoctrinated as far as I'm concerned. But, yeah, they move up different levels. It's very much like an esoteric society. You progress in your, quote-unquote, spiritual maturity based on these assessments that are going on.
Why are they using such terrible music? Some of this sounds like it came right out of the pit of hell. I mean, why? And then I know this is the hallmark of Saddleback Church, is this terrible, terrible music. And a lot of the people don't like it. I mean, it grates on you, but doesn't this have a profound psychological impact?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I believe a lot of it has a hypnotic effect on people. I think a lot of it has to do with the quality of the music. It's not worship anymore. It's a whole different, you know, I'm in a church where we sing the old hymns, the really old hymns. And
worship, and there's sort of an awe of God. But of course this whole new movement is so much more casual. And I saw something on television just the other night. Mm-hmm. It was talking about the Jewish Sabbath and how the true Jew who is celebrating the Sabbath, which starts on Friday evening and goes to Saturday evening, always wears his best clothes. And of course when he goes to the synagogue, he always wears his best. And yet, of course, in our churches today, people come in casual attire, you know, in their slippers or, in their sandals. And even the minister, so many of the ministers now, have taken off their coats and ties, and that's a sports coat and slacks and sandals. And, you know, everything's very casual in the house of the God of the universe who created the heavens and the earth. It just doesn't seem to fit together.
Well, the new music doesn't teach doctrine. When you sing those old hymns, what are those words teaching you? Doctrine? A lot of times they're based on scripture. And, people are not being taught the Word of God anymore. And, of course, that Rick Warren does not use Bible translations that would be steeped in traditional doctrine. He's using things like the Message, which is clearly a New Age translation, and a lot of the other translations to beef up his point that, you know, you can take the Word of God and make it mean whatever you want it to mean.
And for the listener out there, the Message is a new translation of the Bible, and I don't know where they get many of the interpretations, but the whole idea is you got so many interpretations, you say, now, the Bible is the Word of God, but, of course, they're all different. And so what you do is do nothing but confuse the individual. What did God say? What is God's Word? When there are all the different translations, and some of them, by the time you get the Message, has nothing to do with what God said.
That's right. That's right. It's way, way far from the traditional and orthodox understanding. Sometimes I tell people, if you really want to go back and know what the Bible said, read something written over 100 years ago, because that's before psychology and everything else. The structure that they're putting in place is going to demand some accountability and some performance and some outcomes and some standards. One of the organizations that's being set up globally is called the Global Pastors Network, and this is being set up as an offshoot of Campus Crusade. And this organization is trying to locate and identify every pastor on the planet. And this will be data banked. And they are going to go in and offer these men technical assistance. Well, technical assistance, as we know, is a buzzword, probably concocted by Peter Drucker and all of his fellows back during the 60s, where they come in and offer you help so you get on board with the new program. And this is where you set up outcomes for your church. Let's say little Joe Smith at the corner church has a congregation of 100 people, and they come in with one of their technical assistant assessments, and they go to Joe Smith and they say, "Pastor Joe, you've only got 25% of the people in your church tithing, and only 35% of the people in your church are volunteering 5 hours a week. Our program requires that your people perform up to the standard. Therefore, your church is under academic watch? I don't know. Probation? They'll come up with some term for it. But Joe will need to go back and get retraining. He needs to go back to pastor school and learn how to get with the program so that the people in his church start performing better on these assessments."
Well, let's go to Tony from Soquel. Now, before we had Tony from Capitola, and now we have Tony from Soquel. I guess this is Tony's evening. Hi, Tony.
Well, I wonder if there's one in Aptos, too. Dr. Stan, I just had a last remark I wanted to make when you were talking about the attitude in the church. And the word that came to my mind when you were talking about the current situation was, to me, the lack of reverence in the church.
No, there's no awe of God. And no, you're like, reverence, maybe that's a better word.
And that's the thing that's bothered me. I mean, you know, you've known me for a long time, and I complained about these things for a long time, and I probably never used that word reverence, and that it just really troubles me, and it has ever since we've moved to Santa Cruz, because I just don't see it, any reverence, and that was my only comment.
All right. Well, I think it's a very valid comment. And, you know, I am just old and passionate enough to believe that when you go to a church, you wear a coat and tie. And I would do that under every circumstances, you know, unless there's something very, very unusual. But it's almost a sign of disrespect for our Lord. And when the minister won't wear a coat and tie, what is that telling the audience, the members of the congregation? And I think he's giving exactly the message he wants to. Everything's very casual. You know, God is no longer, the maker of heaven and the earth. He's sort of there, and he just loves us all, and there is no condemnation for sin. Let's just live it up. Everybody's going to be happy. And that, of course, is not the gospel of Jesus Christ, as C.S. Lewis said so well in Mere Christianity. And the time when, of course, Christianity has a tremendous impact on society, the people used to think a great deal about the afterlife. Since in modern times, as Christians have thought less about the afterlife, why they have had less impact on society. And I look and see what's happening to society today. And I said, what effect is the church having? And I'd like to say it's almost become irrelevant. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I just go back to reverence, and I'm...
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tony. Bye-bye.
Yeah, one of the things that really strikes me is how man-centered all of this is. It's so presumptuous of man in a church setting to demand this type of accountability, that to the level that they're demanding, that you have to show your work. That's completely contrary to the gospel as far as the church I mean, I believe in accountability and all of that kind of thing and local structure, but this is a whole different formula.
And of course, accountability is to God, not to a group of men.
And especially not to a group of men who are implementing business, secular business practices that actually, many of them being derived from the occult and occult esoteric philosophies. This is superimposing an entirely different structure on the church. And these men spend a huge amount of time trying to concoct new ways of saying this, new doctrines, I call it, of justifying what they're doing. They say we have a new way. We're having a paradigm shift in the church. We're transforming the church. Well,
that's all those things are true, but we're not having a paradigm shift to improve the church, but, of course, to take it away from its real calling. And, of course, the shift that is taking place is not for better, but for worse.
Yes, that's right. That's right. There's actually some of these groups. There's one called the Young Leaders Network, and this is documented by Bob Klink in this a Diaprax conference. But he talks about the Young Leader Network having constructing new theologies for this new church. So not only are they changing the church, but now they're changing the doctrines as well to fit this preconceived model. So the church of the future, go back to the early 90s when we first started seeing these education reform documents, and some of them had this picture, and we called it the hub, those of us that were researching it, because the Department of Education director in the state of Iowa called it the hub. So it was like a series of concentric circles with spokes, and you'd have the school in the center of this, and then you'd have spokes out to job care and health care and all sorts of life things that you would need. And they said the church would be, they said the church was part of the structure. And we were all kind of surprised, because what does the church have to do with the public school? That didn't make sense back in the early 90s. But now when we read these documents coming out of the church reform, they are showing the church completely in line with the government model, which was this hub diagram. And in fact, there was one diagram back in the early 90s from Kennewick, Washington, that showed the state encompassing the church, so that the church was in one of the concentric circles underneath the state's control.
Well, I'm sure this is exactly what is intended. Let's go to Rose calling from New York. Hi, Rose.
Hi.
Nice to hear from you a second time today.
Yes. I have a question. Are these sermons scripted? Because a friend of mine visited some family that were attending two different churches, and she felt they were identical sermons.
Do you want to answer that at all?
Yeah, I believe they are.
Yes, you can actually, yeah. They have these sermons already written out for the ministers, and so they don't have to do anything at all. They can just take down the sermons that have been written by Rick Warren and others,
yeah.
Give those as if that's their own, and then they'll have more time to spend on developing the structure, the corporate structure of their church.
They're on the internet websites, but I also believe that some of them, they put these pastors through these intensive training conferences all the time, and I suspect that they're handed out a lot of sample sermons at those events.
Does that answer your question, Rose?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Well, I would add that I've been speaking to a lot of people who are their churches have been giving this, and they've gone through at least the first course, so to speak, and they keep saying, but there's a lot of good in there. There's a lot of good.
Well, they have to understand that there's a lot of good in snake poison, too. I mean, it's got proteins, and it's got carbohydrates, and it's got vitamins and minerals, but the trouble is the snake poison will kill you. The foundation of this is in the occult, not in Christianity, and that's why this video we have by Dr. Klink is so very important, and of course we've got four tape sets on this. Going into the background, it's all based upon manipulation. Yes, a lot of the things they say are good, but what's the long-term end result of this, Rose? Ask them, you know, where is this going to lead? What about the music? Do you like the music? What about changing the message of the church? Is that, do you really think, going to glorify God? Do we glorify God when we come to church with our sport clothes on? How do you think God feels about the church growth movement? And where is God in that? And when you understand this is all corporate management coming out of Peter Drucker, and the same programs that have been used in the corporate world and in education are being now transformed into the church, and it all has to do with the dialectic. Until people understand that they're playing games with their mind, it's all about manipulation. Try to get them to think. That's all you can do, Rose. If they don't want to listen, that's their problem, because they're going to have to answer sometime before the gates of heaven. And believe me, if we're told in the scriptures, in the end times, there's going to be a great apostasy. And, of course, wide is the way to hell. Very narrow is the road to heaven.
Yes.
Anything else, Rose?
No, God bless you, and thank you.
And God bless you, too. I'm so glad things are going better for you.
Yes, they are. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Rose is an old friend from New York, and for a long time she lived in the city. Now she's in upstate New York, and things are, well, just going so well for her. But it's such a pleasure hearing from her on a regular basis. Anyway, why don't you pick up the story from there, Sarah?
I can really identify with what she's saying. One of the things that happens when you read this is that it all sounds so logical. It sounds so worthy and good. And I can imagine that there's probably some churches that go through this type of program, and maybe they spiff some things up. Maybe they get a little better organized. Maybe they get, you know, a few more people active and involved. And, you know, if you start looking at the external results, which is what this is all about, well, yeah, you start seeing measurable results. Boy, everybody's doing this or everybody's doing that. But what you don't see is what happens behind the scenes. I've got a good friend who has a Down syndrome daughter, and she has to care for elderly parents. She has to care for her Down syndrome daughter, and there's a whole lot of other family and personal and health issues there. And she would never be able to comply with all the requirements and demands that are put on people's time to get involved in community service, to start doing this volunteer work, to start going to this meeting, going to that meeting. I've seen some churches require that you do something every single day of the week that get in this program. What about those people who fall through the cracks, who are never going to be able to perform? What will happen to her? You know, she'll be called a laggard. She'll be, you know, written up as a... It's just like No Child Left Behind. What about those students that don't pass the test? They're a drain on the school system. You know, they've got this set up so that even special ed kids are supposed to be passing this test, which is just, it's utterly nonsensical. But, yeah, I think that there's going to be a backlash or an outcry once there's rewards and penalties that start being instituted. What about those people that can't conform or who won't conform? Will they start being persecuted?
Yeah, they will be put out of the church. They're called pillars, and pillars don't hold up the church. They hold back the church, and those pillars are going to have to be done away with, and they will make it let you know in no uncertain terms that you shouldn't be in the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it exactly. And so this is hard. It's hard on moms who stay at home and take care of their children instead of the yuppie couple where they both go to work and drop their kids off at daycare. It'll be hard on moms who homeschool during the day and don't go to work. This church is built for the modern, you know, go 90 miles an hour society. This is not built for the people who genuinely might have quiet ministries in the background. It's not going to count that you sit on the couch and read stories to your little kids. That's not going to count for volunteer hours in this church structure.
But, of course, the whole thing, as I've said before, is learning how to manipulate the people. And it's all manipulation. And until people understand, that's what it's about. And as they manipulate people in the corporate structure and in education, they carry this over into the church, and exactly the same people are doing exactly the same thing. But what they're doing is they're playing games with our minds, and people have to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sarah, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website or material that you would like people perhaps to get in touch with you and get more information you have on this subject?
Well, I know Barrett Chose has written a very excellent series of articles at www.crossroad.to. It's Crossroad or Crossroads?
Crossroad.to, Port Conger.
Okay, yeah. I recommend Barrett's articles on the Purpose-Driven Church. He's done a lot of background homework. And, of course, I always recommend Charlotte Isserbeet's website, deliberatedumbingdown.com, because a lot of the information on education reform is included in her book. And if you don't understand the program, that's one way you can get up to speed in a hurry, because the same thing that's going on with schools is going to happen to the churches.
All right, fine. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being up. It's midnight. It's past midnight, going on 1 o'clock back there where Sarah is, but she was good enough. I had her as a guest early this morning, and I was so taken with what she had to say, I decided I wanted you to have an opportunity to hear her this evening. So, Sarah Leslie, thank you so very much for being with us, and I'm looking forward to having you as a guest on our programs on a regular basis, if you don't mind coming on.
That would be fine.
God bless you. Good night.
God bless you, too.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Sarah Leslie, and of course, Sarah publishes Charlotte Isabey's wonderful book, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, which, incidentally, is available through Radio Liberty. If you're interested, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927. We'll tell you more about that book. If you'd like to get the copies of the tapes of any of our programs, also the number to call, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. This is the time we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders, our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, do you honestly believe that God is going to ever bless America again? And remember those words of Thomas Jefferson, "I pray for my country that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever." And so until we're with you again, we're going to be away for a few days, but we'll be back hopefully next week. Until then, may the Lord be with you. The programs will go on without me. We've got some great programs lined up. Until next week, may the Lord be with you.